Hello and welcome to Tech Tent. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones and this is your weekly status update on the technology business. After last week's outside broadcast excitement, we're back in our virtual tent come studio right next to the BBC's technology news desk. And I'm joined from the tech team by Carolyn Rice.
Hi, Rory.
And by Dave Lee.
Hi.
And our very special guest this week is Belinda Palmer, founder of Lady Geek, a campaign to get more women interested and employed in technology.
Hello, Rory.
Belinda, and we'll come to this later, is wearing all sorts of interesting technology. But first, this week.
We are still awaiting information from the Australian search and rescue operation as to whether the objects shown in the satellite images released by Australia yesterday are indeed related to MH370.
Now, that was the Malaysian Transport Minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, at a news conference a few hours ago. And the ongoing search for the missing Malaysian airliner has dominated the news for nearly 2 weeks. Much of the focus in that hunt for clues about the plane's fate has been on satellite data and on images in particular. We're all used to the idea that satellites are all seeing, that Hollywood movie concept that you can just switch on a satellite and have instant images of somebody walking down the street in some far-flung place. But how realistic is this, and what are the challenges in trying to spot possible debris from an aircraft from satellite images? I spoke to Professor Yang Gao from the University of Surrey, who's an expert on satellite imaging.
There are several challenges. For example, it does take time for even state-of-the-art satellite to revisit the same place on Earth. And the current, I think, best system allows that to take place within a day. Secondly, there is also issues with the large amount of data we have to process on ground in order to extract useful information. There are also issues to do with the quality of the data we get from the spacecraft. They don't tend to be always very good and easy to use. For example, we very often get image about a surface area that is covered by clouds, and sometimes the spacecraft might have vibrations on board which cause the image to be very blurry.
That's Professor Yang Gao. Dave Lee, you've been looking at this story too. Getting satellites to the right place, getting the right images, is a huge challenge, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, I spoke to a company called Digital Globe this week, which launched one of these crowdsourcing tools that allows just anyone in the public to look at these images. And the biggest problem for them, like you say, is getting the right images into the system, because the search for this plane has changed. The focus of where they need to be has changed, and they do this overnight. They can move their satellites and look at a certain place, but that the images from those satellites has to be uploaded, and that takes a little while.
And it isn't easy, is it, just to point a satellite at a particular place, even if you knew where the particular place was supposed to be, and this is a huge area.
Absolutely, and they say they can adjust where they want to put it within 20 minutes, but that whole process to gather all that data and make sure it's accessible on the website is a huge task.
Huge technology being employed there, but we're seeing some of its limitations right now. Okay, let's move on to more of the top stories from this week. Microsoft has been reading a blogger's email, Carolyn Rice. Take us through this. How does that fit in with their privacy policy?
Yes, well, it's an interesting story. Microsoft admitted that it had read the Hotmail inbox of a blogger during an investigation it was carrying out into a software leak. This blogger, who is anonymous, we don't know who they are, posted screenshots of the then unreleased Windows 8 operating system. And Microsoft wanted to find out who had given this blogger that information, so they accessed the Hotmail inbox. Now, the search was legal because it's covered by Microsoft terms and conditions, but it's a little bit embarrassing for them because they've been quite critical in the past of Google and them scanning its users' emails.
And of course they and lots of other Silicon Valley companies have been complaining about NSA surveillance. It looks as if you look very deep into their terms and conditions, they're allowing themselves to have a look at your email too in certain circumstances. Meanwhile, in Turkey, there's a battle of wills going on between the government and Twitter users. The Prime Minister promised to wipe Twitter out after it was used to spread allegations of corruption. But when access was blocked, the country's many tweeters, and there are an awful lot of them, found ways around the ban. Even the President has been tweeting criticism in the last few hours of the Prime Minister. So this morning, I had a quick word with the BBC's Rengin Arslan in Ankara and asked her how she and others have got round the ban.
On the computer, DNS is working well. When you change the numbers simply, you can access to Twitter and many other banned internet sites in Turkey. For the phone, many people saying VPN is working, so I just downloaded onto my phone from App Store.
So
that was easy.
So you got yourself a virtual private network, a VPN app. You downloaded it onto your phone, and then you were able to tweet from your phone.
That's right. My timeline is flowing like storm, I can say. Many people are tweeting and sharing the links and saying the ban is not working. The government cannot ban the Twitter in Turkey.
So it's not been very effective then, the ban on Twitter?
No, it's nothing.
That's Ringin Aslan still tweeting from Ankara. Dave Lee, you've got an interesting story about the professionalisation of video piracy.
Yes, Roy. Over the past week, we've seen the emergence of a service called Popcorn Time, which essentially adds a user-friendly interface to watch movies illegally, which obviously means without having to pay. The service was made by programmers in Argentina, and they've made the software open source, which means anyone can copy it and adapt it, which makes it very, very hard to shut down.
It was shut down. It's reopened as open source. It's been backed by what some have called the king of piracy, Kim.com.
Yeah, Kim.com described it as Hollywood's worst nightmare, and he himself is at the centre of his own case. He used to be the owner of, you may remember, Mega Upload, which was closed down in January 2012. He was arrested back then, accused of copyright theft on a massive scale. The US want to see him extradited from New Zealand, where he currently lives, to the US to face the charges. But once again this week, that extradition was delayed. It won't happen now until July at the very earliest.
Yeah, pirates winning on lots of fronts at the moment. Carolyn, Mt. Gox, the bankrupt Bitcoin exchange. That's got some interesting news.
Yes, Rory. How often have you put your wallet in a pair of trousers and hung them up in the cupboard and forgot about it? Because essentially that's what's happened here, but on a massive scale. Mt. Gox, just to remind you, they filed for bankruptcy in February after saying they'd lost about 800,000 bitcoins to hackers. That's 7% roughly of all bitcoins in existence, and about $500 million worth, so quite a lot.
A lot to lose.
They've now said they found 200,000 bitcoins, about $116 million, in an old digital wallet. Now, they thought this was empty. He didn't contain any bitcoins, but went back to search for it and just happened to find it.
Rummaged behind their digital sofa, as it
exactly,
were.
Exactly, yes.
Well, my what fun. Well, musicians have been complaining loudly about how little they make from the streaming service Spotify. But here's a funny thing. One band, the funk outfit Volfipek, I think I've said that right, they think their new album could be a guaranteed money spinner. Just listen to this track from their Sleepify album. No, don't worry. The BBC technology isn't broken. That and every other track on the Sleepify album consists of silence. Nothing but silence. Volfipek's worked out that it gets half a cent every time a track is played on Spotify. So it's asking its fans to stream the album on repeat all night. And the result, says the band, is that the sound of silence will generate $4 a night. If enough fans do it, their next tour can go ahead. Pretty ingenious, eh, folks?
It's already better than Justin Bieber, isn't it?
Yes. Depends on your musical tastes. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with Rory Catlin-Jones. Please share your thoughts with us via our Twitter feed at BBC Tech Tent. Now, wearable technology, it's supposed to be the next battleground for the major tech companies. Everything from smart watches like Samsung's Galaxy Gear to smart glasses like Google Glass, any number of fitness monitors and wristbands. This week, Motorola showed its attempt at a smart watch using new Android software designed especially for wearables. But this sector is very much in its infancy. I went to the Wearable Technology Show in London, where I met Dave Evans, chief futurist for the networking giant Cisco, and I asked whether he thinks these devices will really be money spinners for their makers.
Wearable technology by itself is not new in a sense. Humans have adorned themselves with stuff, if you will, tattoos, piercings, jewelry, for more than 100,000 years, in fact, before recorded history. We're sort of in phase two of a continuum. So phase one was the adornment phase. Phase two is the wearable phase. And there's sort of an adjective, sort of wearable, which is a wearable. So the wearable that you wear today tells you what you're doing, but not how you're doing. That's the next phase. The next phase is, how is your body doing from a biological perspective? And then we get even more sort of provocative after that, where we get past wearables to embeddables, where you actually embed technology in you. And then where it gets really interesting is later on, and it's a couple of decades out, we may even get into the replaceable phase. So you may take a perfectly good, for example, set of eyes and say, you know what, I'm going to change them with something completely replaceable that's completely artificial, because these artificial eyes are going to give me zoom vision, perhaps. They're never going to wear out like my biological eyes do. And maybe we'll throw an infrared while we're at it so you can see at night.
Right now, aren't they appealing to quite a small market? Frankly, the self-obsessed, people who want to record everything they do.
It is absolutely a nascent market today. In 2014, it's expected to be about a $2.9 billion market. Over the course of the next decade, it's expected to grow to about a $70 billion market. So it's growing pretty fast. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 160, 170 unique companies doing wearable technology. And I would characterize it perhaps as a phase of, let's call it sort of rational experimentation, where we're trying different form factors, different models, different societal acceptance models. Like, will society accept the fact that you're wearing a camera that records everything that's going on?
Who's going to be big in this area? And are they really betting big time in it? Are the Googles, the Apples, the Samsungs, are they really counting on making a lot of money out of this?
I don't think the industry yet knows how big or small wearable technology is going to be. I think it's actually going to be quite big. And you'll see a lot of companies, whether it's a company like Cisco, investing in the infrastructure to connect all of these things. We call it the Internet of Everything, connecting the billions upon billions of things on our planet. Or the companies like Intel that are building new types of wearable technologies, like Edison, sort of 22-nanometer technology to enable wearable technology. Apple from a consumer perspective. So a lot of companies are, let's say, playing in this space, because humans have an obsession to be connected and to connect with information.
You mentioned the Internet of Things, the Internet of Everything, as some people call it. People hear about things like the Internet fridge. I've been hearing about that for a decade, and laugh and think this is all a bit trivial. Give us a real-world example of why this would be important.
Let's take cities. So, turn of last century, 3% of the world lived in cities. Today, about 50% of people live in cities. And by about 2050, there are about 70 to 80% of the world will live in cities. That's going to put tremendous stress on those cities in terms of energy management, transportation. I mean, if you think...
But what does the Internet of Things do to that? That's not what I struggle to understand.
So first of all, you can't manage what you can't measure. So by connecting all of these things, you get insight into what they're doing, and you can measure them. You can manage them more intelligently.
And that all ties into the whole big data theme. Hasn't that been slightly oversold? There's not much evidence so far that people are doing, getting as much from this data as was promised.
So we're still in the early stages with this whole big data and analytics. So there's two parts to this. There's big data, which is the creation of massive amounts of data. Now, without analytics to mine it and separate the wheat from the chaff, it's just noise. So in the coming years, we're developing more and more tools to parse all this data, this rich data. By the way, 90-plus percent of this data flowing across the network is rich media. It's the videos that you're taking today. It's rich content. So we need more tools and technologies that can parse this stuff so we can take action on it. And one of the things that we know it as, or one of the things we call it as, is context. Today, there's so many things and services vying for your attention. So whether it's social media sites or your email or calendars or Twitter or text messaging, we can't keep up with the demand. So what's happening over time is, because of IoT, because things now know who you are, where you are, and what you're doing, information and services are going to start finding you instead of you having to go find it. That's context. And that's how we're going to manage this massive amount of data that we're creating. It's about information finding you at the right place at the right time, based on what your needs are, based on what you're doing.
That's Dave Evans of Cisco with that vision of the future where we're all online through our wearable tech. And Belinda Palmer from Lady Geek is with us, wearing a lot of technology. Belinda, are you really convinced that this is taking off? Because it's not that fashionable, is it?
So wearable technology is in a similar place to where mobile phones were in the 1980s. You know, they were ugly, they were bulky, they were cumbersome, and they had terrible battery lives. You could equally put all of those criticisms to the wearable space at the moment. You know, there's a lot of ugly stuff out there. There's a lot of gimmicky thing, like the vibrating pants you were telling me about just before the show. And a lot of it is impractical, like the video logging software that takes pictures of my life every 30 seconds. And to be honest, it's quite a boring life I have.
We're both wearing those cameras, and it has to say, you begin to ask, what is the point after a while? And a lot of this, it is quite, vain, isn't it? We're all trying to document our lives with these devices.
We are. I mean, the point of this software is that the video logging that takes pictures of our lives every 30 seconds is that we can actually be in the moment. But it's got to a point where people are so obsessed about capturing the moment that we've actually forgot the moment. And it got to a point where I had a friend who said, oh, I can't wait to go to Argentina so I can put pictures on my, update my Flickr page.
Are we looking at the wrong type of devices here? What is there something that is going to convince people beyond the geeks, frankly, that this is something they need in their lives?
There is a glimmer of hope. I'm excited about the wearable space when it starts to solve a real problem. And I think, you know, I've got a purse here with a battery charger inside. That, for me, is beautiful, which is important, and actually solves a problem in my life. And that's where wearable technology needs to go, away from the gimmicky, into solving real problems in people's lives. And that's incredibly exciting.
That will be exciting when it happens. Let's hope it happens soon. Now, TED, heard of that? Well, it's the trendiest tech conference around. Too trendy, according to some cynics, but an essential guide to the future, according to others who are fans of the long-running event. This week, it's been taking place in Vancouver in Canada and has featured everyone from Google's Larry Page to the web's creator, Tim Berners-Lee, with much of the discussion centering on the whole privacy and surveillance debate. And guess who also is there? Our very own Jane Wakefield. And late last night, she sent us this dispatch.
Greetings from Vancouver, first of all. I'm here reporting on the TED conference, which, for those people that don't know, stands for Technology, Entertainment and Design. We've had a host of interesting speakers during the course of the last 4 days, including Bill Gates, Larry Page, the co-founder of Google. But perhaps the most interesting debate that's happened here this week has been the one about Edward Snowden and the leaks that he made about the NSA's mass surveillance program, NSA standing for National Security Agency. He spoke on Tuesday. Obviously, he didn't come in person. He was beamed into the conference via a robotic screen and had a very interesting debate about some of the things that he's revealed and his thoughts on openness of the web and where we should be going next after these revelations. A few days later, the NSA's deputy director spoke, Richard Leggett, and he talked about the dangers that Snowden had created by releasing these secrets. He revealed that 42 terrorist plots had been foiled by the PRISM program, and he said that the fact that that enemy states and terrorists and traffickers now knew the workings of the NSA meant that many of them were stepping away, finding new methods to do things, and that as a result the NSA was losing visibility of their adversaries, as he put it. So that was a very interesting debate, and the reaction to it has been interesting too. So a lot of the conference goers were very welcoming to Edward Snowden. I mean, they were equally welcoming to Richard Leggett, but they did give more of a standing ovation to Edward Snowden. He got a very rousing round of applause. Lots of people here feeling that the debate that he has started is a really important one. The NSA did say that they wanted to enter into that debate, but whether they will be giving the amount of disclosure that people would like remains to be seen. Google co-founder Larry Page also spoke at TED, and he criticised the government surveillance program and questioned how it was possible to live in a democracy when a government was able to kind of implement these secret programs. The NSA, for its part, said that everything it has done has been done with the full authority of the government, federal law, and Congress. So a very interesting debate here, and I think as the months go by, we'll see whether any of the things that they have talked about actually are put into action. The NSA promising some transparency reports, so we'll see how that goes.
Thanks to Jane Wakefield for sending us that postcard from Vancouver. And Google's co-founder Larry Page had some more interesting things to say beyond government surveillance. He said Google, which bought the British artificial intelligence firm DeepMind recently, was working on its own machine learning project using YouTube to teach computers. Here's an intriguing thing. It's learnt what cats are, he said. Fascinating. He also wants everyone to hand over their medical data, anonymised, to researchers, claiming that could save 100,000 lives. More debates for sure about just how much of our data we want to hand over to anyone, let alone Google. Moving on. All this week, a storm has been brewing over Silicon Valley, over the treatment of women in computing. It was sparked by the resignation of Julianne Horvath, a senior engineer at the social computing firm GitHub. She'd earlier been positive about the culture of that company, but now says she faced sexist attitudes. Others have said there's a wider problem, especially at more junior levels in the tech industry. Our North America technology correspondent, Richard Taylor, asked for the views of a few women tech workers in Silicon Valley.
I'm at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and as I walk around this vast trade show hall, what is really striking is just how few women there are here, perhaps one in 20, maybe even one in 30. Now, interestingly, a lot of women were not prepared to come and talk on the record about their experiences being female in a very male-dominated world. I did find one or two who are prepared to talk. One of them is Kate Craig, who makes game environments for some of the games that we see.
Well, I think there's a lot of to-do about overt sexism sometimes, but the more malicious stuff, the more insidious stuff is kind of what I've experienced. A lot of being ignored, a lot of being spoken over or just not included in things is the vast majority of what I felt. And it's sort of the signal-to-noise thing kind of throws it off because you don't realize if it's just, is it me or is it just because like I'm a woman and this is sort of what I kind of run into.
Another young female coder I spoke to anonymously currently works at one of the big Silicon Valley tech giants. She says her company is very progressive towards women, but she also feels that the gender imbalance is insidious in its own right.
I think the tech culture in particular has built up this myth, which itself subscribes to some extent, which is that it sort of perfected the workplace. It's sort of this great place where you can work and have all your freedom and work on what projects you want, all of which I think is somewhat true. But I think when you begin to really think of yourself as a meritocracy, you begin to forget that all of people's work doesn't happen within a social vacuum. And I think in some part, it's the success of Silicon Valley and welcoming a very diverse group of people that maybe makes people complacent and which makes it a little more dangerous. Because we pay less attention, I think, sometimes, because we think we've already got the job done.
Another woman who was prepared to talk to me openly is Chris Freeman. She makes a mobile carpool app. She's gay and says her lack of overt femininity helps her fit in a bit more.
There's one case where if it's just me and I'm with a bunch of guys, there's the standard guy-girl thing where I'm the girl and like, oh, she might not know as much. She's not as savvy in the tech world. Whereas if I'm in a room where there are other women who present more femininely, and I'm the one who looks more like a boy, like I'm one of the guys, I get a little bit of a pass. Like I get a little bit of masculinity privilege. So they'll tend to, you know, I guess be a little bit more deferential to me because they assume that, well, she's kind of one of us, so maybe she knows a little bit more.
Chris told me of a kind of soft misogyny at play. She says while the tech culture is slowly improving, there's still a long way to go before women feel like equals.
I think in technology, it's particularly precarious because there are fewer women going into these fields, going into it in the higher education, going into it in terms of like job searching, because there's that culture fit question or this, hey, I'm going to hook up my buddy that I've known since high school because I know him and I know he can get by and we can work it out. Whereas if you're a woman coming into it without that network, you're kind of left to fend for yourself. You're kind of flailing around.
Belinda Palmer, you started the whole Lady Geek campaign, campaigning for women to get more access to technology jobs and so on. How do you think progress is being made at the moment?
Well, I think we need to make the point that not every dispute involving a woman is sexism. And as somebody who campaigns for that and cares deeply about this, we need to be very careful and not use the misogyny word casually. And the whole GitHub thing, I mean, on a first appearance, it appears there was a lot more going on there than sexism. Obviously, I don't know the ins and outs. I guess the point is we need to demasculinise the technology industry. That doesn't mean feminise it, but we do need to make it an environment where women can flourish.
What I found frightening reading some of the blogs about this is the comments under the blogs from males in the computing industry were outrageous, really. Did you read any of that?
I mean, I never read comments because they always tell me I'm mentally imbalanced on my own articles or all sorts of atrocities. So, yeah, I mean, there's comments there, but I think we need to do a couple of things. Number one, make an environment where women can flourish. Number two, we need to actually make it celebrate femininity and the values that women can bring. And number three, we've got to get the next generation of girls because, as in the report, only 17% of the technology workforce is female. So we've got to inspire the next generation of girls to want to come in the industry.
Karen Rice, you're a woman in technology. What's your take on this?
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, I've had various jobs in technology. I trained as an engineer and I was always in the minority. But I have to say that the more sexist attitudes I found weren't in those arenas. They've been in much more different office arenas where I was surprised to find it. I think in technology, people are often quite welcoming. And, you know, sometimes you have to prove yourself to an extent, but I'm not sure that would be any more different with a group of women.
Belinda, do you think you're winning this battle?
I think it's a really complex problem. I don't think the next Mark Zuckerberg is going to be female just yet. But I think we really need to raise the debate and keep awareness and keep talking about it.
Well, we are running out of time in this week's programme. Thanks to Belinda Palmer and to Carolyn Rice and Dave Lee. And a big thanks to you all for listening. Remember, you can comment on the programme or tell us what you'd like us to cover on our Twitter account @BBC Tech Tent. We look forward to you joining us in the tent next week.